swap screens here, and then I will join you. Right. Let's see if I can not take off.
I will say, Ryan, that I did a reading in Regina, as Regina chapters for 7 people.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, well, and I felt really bad about it, and they were like, Arthur Black was here last week, and he got 4.
Yeah, I don't feel bad about this. I don't think they're going to see my head. Nope, they're not going to see my head. There's just no ways about that. Well, that's okay.
Why not to angle
books.
The...
Grab a book to angle it up.
Exactly. These things called books are the solution.
Yeah.
I mean, many problems, to be fair.
We have many books.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And let's just make sure it gets us both.
Yeah, let's do that. Have a seat and they'll let us know.
Okay.
I will. You sit and I will fix it.
Will we know?
Okay. That sounds
like a good idea. Oh, you have the brain cell today. I was wondering.
No, I don't have it right now. I have it right now. I didn't have it earlier.
So, okay, Kim and I share a brain cell, but she said she also shares a brain cell with you.
Yeah.
You're
you
live to the
cell,
internet.
That's fine.
Okay.
I have no problem with that. So, when you have the brain cell, and Kim and I go kayaking, neither of us has it?
There's one communal one that just gets shared around to whoever needs it the most at any given time.
Yeah, okay,
but
so
it doesn't always
time,
work out.
Yeah, that time that we went by, like, the Edmonton Queen docks that night, Jill had the brain cell. That all checks out. That's the only possible
explanation.
Did
you drop your phone in the river, too?
Oh, God, that was Molly's fault.
Sure
was.
You know
but
what?
I know she's not here to defend herself when you do that. Just so
I'm
that.
Really glad that my book has such huge print, because otherwise it's very dark in this corner. How are you going to do?
I'm fine.
Yeah? You don't have old, light-sensitive eyes like me?
I'm not blind. So I'm supposed to introduce you.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm just going to say thank you to everybody who's here in person. For those of you who may or may not be watching. Hold on, I think we may have another one.
No, that's something in the code.
All right.
Okay.
For anyone who's joining us on the internet, I apologize for the sound quality. Unfortunately, our lav mics turned out to be a no-go today. There's always some technical issue, but thank you for watching. Thank you, folks, for coming. I'll hand it off to you.
Should we turn off the...
Oh, yes, you should. Thank you. Tyler's got the brain cell.
We're just going to turn off the background music.
Yeah. It's on the floor under the keyboard.
Under the keyboard.
Yeah, it's a tiny little thing on the floor under the keyboard.
But it's just a little Bluetooth.
Oh,
speaker.
I thought it was the keyboard.
Okay. It's a great little speaker. I'm really happy with it. No, that's it. You got it. So.
I'm going to say one of my, my boyfriend or my husband probably has our shared brain cell. Actually, between the three of us, I think we lost it, because we all have ADD, so...
Yeah, I mean, if it's somewhere in your house, I don't know if it's going to be found.
We're talking about brain cells. We're talking about not having them. Okay.
This is my long-term housemate, Ryan States, and he goes by Laird Ryan States as an author, because it's impossible to look up Ryan States on the internet.
That's perfect.
So it's Paul Ryan States, and nobody needs to see that.
Yep.
So ages ago, Ryan wrote a funny little thing on the internet where he kind of pretended that he had been to some island called Salisbury looking for some old relatives. And that evolved into a book called Sleeping Underwater that was published 2 years ago or last year?
2020. 2019. God, we're all getting old and time is
pressing. Yeah. Because Ryan definitely does things with the best possible time, and his book came out in late 2019. And it's a really fun, strange novel, great characters, a lot of Beatles.
A lot of
drug references. But yeah, it's great, and it's sort of all centered on this island called Salisbury. And so Ryan now has a new book that's just out this year. Called Somebody Else's Story, and it has a lot of the same characters, and also the Frankenstein monster, and also his schlong.
Yep, that's true. It's actually called Someone Else's Story, but don't feel bad because I keep calling it Somebody Else's Story every time
I
talk to people about it.
Frankenstein monster schlong or Ryan's?
Oh, Frankenstein monster schlong.
It's the same thing.
I was just looking for some clarity.
I can neither confirm nor deny, so.
So, I'm gonna read a little bit from someone else's story. Someone else's story is narrated by Tom Bradstreet, who is a minor character in Sleeping Underwater, who, as a result of the events of that book, winds up immortal and not loving that. So he's a man in his 80s who looks like he's in his early 40s, and he is coping with this very poorly, largely through alcohol. He has moved to Edmonton, Canada, for a number of different reasons, which aren't important to the section that I'm reading, but the way that he manages his life is he still works as a freelance journalist, and occasionally he takes cases assigned to him by the British intelligence agency that's devoted to dealing with cases of the supernatural. And he has been asked to go investigate this performance artist called William S. Frankenstein, who uses surgery as an art form and has really, really gross performance art. And so he goes to meet William S. Frankenstein, discovers that he is in fact the Frankenstein monster, and the Frankenstein monster finds him fascinating because he won't die. So the section that I'm going to read here is a an example of Frankenstein setting up for one of these performance pieces using Tom as the exhibit. So I'm just going to read from that now. Oh, out loud, sorry. Okay. socially awkward. Okay. I woke up in chains like King Kong. A great manacle around my neck held me to the wall, and cuffs at my ankles and my wrists were heavy enough that my urge to struggle waned quickly. When I craned my head slightly, I found myself in a black room with theater lighting. I was still dressed in the same way, but the front of my shirt was even bloodier than I remembered. It looked as though Frankenstein and his children had played with me a little more. I took care to breathe evenly, tried to listen hard. The furnace was ticking away somewhere, and I thought I could hear talking in the next room, but I wasn't certain. Our brains like to play that trick on us. The way my head was chained, I meant I couldn't see much past my own chest. I wasn't desperate enough yet to skin my own hand to get out of the handcuffs. Wouldn't help if I couldn't get my head freed, and I wasn't brave enough to try anything that foolish with my head. Frankenstein came into the room a moment later with a clipboard in his hand. On either side of him were two men who looked like backstage technicians, long hair and ponytails, scruffy jeans and tool belts. He directed them as to the positioning of lights. When he realized I was awake, he excused himself and came over to me. "Hello, Tom," he said. "I trust you're feeling better. Take these fucking chains off me, or I swear to God I am going to make you sorry." He acted as if he hadn't heard me speak at all. "You're really a fascinating creature." He took off his glove and showed me his right hand. My right hand. It turns out that I really could recognize the back of my own hand. I could see the livid stitches where he'd sewn it to his wrist. And I had nothing readily to say about that. It took me 7 tries to graft one on, but happily your hand just kept growing back over and over again, so I could try again and again. I wriggled my own hand, feeling the fingers move. "It does that." He nodded solemnly. "You cut off your own hand?" I asked. "I had some help, but yes." "How long was I out?" "Just a day. I thought it was best to keep you under while I did my explorations." "Thanks." Frankenstein put his glove back on and went back to his workmen. After a few minutes, they left. Frankenstein sat on the bench seating across the stage from me, crossed a leg over, and massaged the calf. "Oh, it's not easy to be so damnably tall," he said. "Pain all the time, and unlike my darling wife, I've not developed a taste for it." "Have you considered suicide?" "Of course not. The show must go on. For one thing, it's a mortal sin. For another, my creator endowed me with a fierce tenacity and a desire to stay alive. My natural instinct for self-preservation would never allow me to walk into a blast furnace, nor to stand by while some tiny little man with a knife tried to cut my throat. No matter how much I can see it's for the best, no, and more's the pity, I have a taste for vengeance."
Your camera went out.
Yeah.
Hold on, guys, we're just going to get the camera to come back
on. No, it's still working.
No, it's black.
Now it's not.
It's just slow.
Turn it off. Turn it on.
We can hear you.
Yeah. Sorry, folks.
Okay, I may not be the one to do technology, given my luck with technology, but...
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, no, nope, somebody else is gonna have to play.
So the switch to turn it off and on is right on top.
Yeah.
And once you turn it back on, then it's gonna ask you to let it go into streaming mode. And why it keeps shutting off, I do not know.
Okay.
Are we good?
Yep, I'm surplus to requirements, so just
all right.
Away with you.
Sorry. No, and more's the pity, I have a taste for vengeance. Well, that's great. You intend to torture me, then. I've been tortured before. I was even tortured a couple of times when it still left scars. Frankenstein leaned his entire weight back onto his long arms, his legs straight out before him. I saw that, yes. I don't torture people. It's pointless. I'm only interested in exploring how far their limits will take them. I don't know what it would take to actually destroy you, but I am interested, aren't you? No. You know what interests me? Beer. Sex, a good book, a good movie, a good laugh, and that's more or less the whole lot for me. Anything else I can take or leave. Simple tastes, he said. Mine too. So what is all this then? I asked, trying to gesture with my hand. Well, I'm preparing for an impromptu show before we leave Vancouver. It's all very last minute, but I had to strike while the iron was hot. I thought to myself, MI-13 might still have half an eye on me. Heather was expecting a call. At least Lisa was expecting me home on Sunday. It wasn't much hope, but even the smallest drop is something when you're shitting your pants in terror. I am part of the show, I presume. Of course. Is there a script I should memorize or anything? No, the piece works best if you are entirely surprised. What's it called? I asked, trying to be conversational, trying not to give him the pleasure inherent in seeing me panic. Violet Swarm. My heart pounded in my chest. Do excuse me, he said, and he left. I realized then that his mind-raping bitch of a wife intended to make all of my nightmares come true. I screamed. I screamed again. I continued screaming, literally ad nauseum, and the vomit was bloody from my irritated throat. I sagged limply in my chains. How are the levels on that? Frankenstein asked someone in the hall. Fine, was the reply. Miranda came into the room then, dressed in a man's suit with a vest. She came right up to me and jabbed a needle into my neck. I didn't mind. I fell into a dark and dreamless place. Time had no meaning for me whatsoever. It might have been an hour later, or it might have been a year. Three people stood in front of me staring. One of them was a rather famous Canadian filmmaker known for making films nearly as obsessed with flesh as Frankenstein himself. He moved his thick black frames down his nose slightly to get a better look at something. That, he said, really is remarkable. Do it again. I felt a sharp pain in my chest and some blood misted up onto my chin. A little bit spattered his glasses. I couldn't see who'd cut me. Fuckers, I said, my voice slurring. I'll kill all you lousy primates. Jesus, he's awake, the filmmaker said, jerking back suddenly and hiding his face. Don't be like that, came Frankenstein's voice over the sound system. After all, Tom, you're my right-hand man. The next section I'm going to read comes from significantly later in the book. When we learn a little bit more about William S. Frankenstein's history, and it turns out that at the end of the original novel, Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster and his creator ride off on an ice foil, supposedly to die. But instead, Frankenstein's monster wound up surviving and roaming the world. And in the 1950s, he wound up serving with the French Foreign Legion and settling in Tangiers, where he met the Beat writer William S. Burroughs. They developed a romantic relationship that ended when Frankenstein felt the need to move on, as he often does. But this chapter is a letter from William Burroughs later in his life to the Frankenstein monster. My dear monster, off the coast of Gibraltar, isolated from damn near any other place of land whatsoever, is a small island called Salisbury. You may have heard of the place, considering your travels and how damn strange you are. It would surprise me somewhat if you had not. I try to visit the place every few years, which is easy enough for me as a cock-sucking American. They don't let colonials on the island, which probably includes you, and most especially includes you if you're really German, about which I have strong doubts. I go because I find the people there to be the most disagreeable people on Earth. There is damn close to no kind of law there at all, and because they stay the hell out of your business. I also go because they have a drug made from the glands of a beetle that is unlike anything I have ever put in my body. It does things to a human brain that might more rightly be left to the province of the gods. The island has got nothing else but of beetles. They have plenty. The ground is thick with them. You get used to sliding around in their guts, and everyone there is sharing some kind of low-level unity high. The drug is telepathic, I think. Changes you. It's a million times better than Yaga, and I sometimes regret that I wasted a lot of time tramping about in jungles in South America. Last year, I went for what will turn out to be my last time, I suspect. When I was there, I met a woman named Miranda. She recognized me and insisted on speaking with me, even though I was quite clearly trying to read a book. I find it damn near impossible to be rude to a person, no matter how much they are imposing upon my privacy, and we started to talk. She told me she was 300 years old and that she was a kind of parasite that made its living by jumping from one human host into another. She was, she said, an ardent fan of my work, and that when she first read The Ticket That Exploded, she felt understood for the first time. You have to understand, and in fact I'm sure that you do, that I endure this kind of tiresome nonsense with some regularity. People seem to think they need to work overtime to be interesting to me. It's exhausting and demoralizing, but I suppose it's nice to be recognized. Anyway, she knew that I had spent a lot of time in Interzone, and she asked if I had met a German there named Frankenstein. This piqued my interest, and I said that, as a matter of fact, I had. She clapped her hands and demanded that I tell her all about you. I told her that you'd shown me and Ginsburg around a few places, and you and I had talked and said nothing of any real consequence. A gentleman never tells except in his filthy books. She told me then that she knew your father, the famous scientist Victor Frankenstein, the one from the book. The book, she said, was true, but by no means was it the full story, and that I was a lot closer than I knew to the truth about the Nova Mob and the Nova Heat, and she asked if I had ever actually met a mugwump. Naturally, I said I had. Why should she be the only one of spewing nonsense? She asked if I'd liked it, and if I wanted another taste. She leaned in closer and smiled, open-mouthed. She flicked her tongue up, and under it, I could see a small, fleshy thing that writhed like an earthworm, trying not to drown. I jerked back without really intending to, and I started to believe she was some kind of hallucination, or worse, some terrible reality. On Celsory, you can wind up seeing both of those things. She laughed then and told me she was teasing, and that I was far too old for that kind of drug. My heart couldn't take it anymore. I laughed politely, relieved, but my ego was still bruised. She explained that she had been looking for you for a long time, and she was sure she could help you discover a great many things. She considered herself to be, in some sense at least, your mother. I claimed I had long since lost touch, seeing no particular need to foist this madwoman or monster or mugwump upon you. She asked me then if I would mind taking her name and her address, so that if I were to meet you again, I might pass it on. I said that I would. She took a picture with a Polaroid land camera, and that picture was in the box. She also wrote for me there at the table the sealed note in an envelope and gave it to me. She kissed me on both cheeks and apologized for disturbing me. She left. I did not see her again. This was weird, as there is only one hotel on Celsory that you might want to stay at. I kept these things and meant to mail them, but I never did. At this point, it's likely they'll find the whole package with this letter on top after I've finally died, and you'll get it that way. Getting old is a mortal pain, Adam. If you can avoid it, do. It occurs to me in closing that everything she said about you may have been true. If so, then I want to tell you on behalf of the whole human race that we are sorry. We treat everything, but most especially our children, like garbage. We're scared by anything that might sound like hard work, and we resent that you'll keep going on long after we're in the ground. You seemed every bit as human as most people I know, which is, as you know, not so much a compliment as a statement of fact. I'm certain you're terribly lonely. If it makes you feel any better, we all are. We're all creations that our parents abdicated responsibility for. We all learned how to act from reading old books and spying on happy families through windows. We're all imposters trying to pass as normal people, whatever the hell that even means. You are just a living metaphor for the universal human experience. If, on the other hand, she was just a terminal fool and an attention seeker and paid us no mind, if she was a mugwump, drink deep. That's the kind of high that men will kill and die for. Your friend, William Lee, New York City, 1997. Thank you. All right.
So this camera's running a little hot.
This camera's running a little hot, is it?
Yeah, so it needs a break, so I guess let's turn it on once I'm actually doing the reading.
All right, we're going to take a little break on the camera. You'll still be able to hear me. We're not sure why the camera doesn't like this, but apparently it doesn't. I'm going to introduce Scalene, who is, of course, my friend and my platonic life pal. We have been living together and writing in the same house for almost 30 years now. Good God. Sold. Scalene has written many books. She wrote Touch and Grayling Cross. Recently, she has released three books, which are all on sale here tonight with Dream Spinner Press. She's got a series of detective novels featuring Ben Ames and his boyfriend. The first two of those are The Girl Whose Luck Ran Out and The Man Who Lost His Pen. Yesterday, Galen's third book with Dream Spinner came out. It's called Lightning Strike Blues. And Lightning Strike Blues is a book, if you have been following my Facebook, you'll know I can't be objective about. The path of this book coming to print has been a long, long one. Hello. The path of the book coming to print has been a long, long one. It started out as a role-playing game. Then we actually pitched it as a TV series and got a producer's interest. It didn't pan out in the long run. Eventually went ahead and tried to do it as a radio show where folks who came became our lifelong friends, like Kim, who's here. The characters in Lightning Strike Blues are characters that I love deeply. Some of them I'm deeply scared of. But they are as true and dear to me as my own closest friends at this point. And so objectively looking at this book, I can't. But I'm very glad to see it come to print, and I'm very glad that she's here to read it to us tonight. So I'm going to move off camera here and try and get this running for her so she can read.
All right. So the story so far, where we're going to pick up tonight, 18-year-old Gabriel Reese is having kind of a weird night. He just accidentally outed himself to his redneck older brother Colin, who is also his roommate. And now he's on a motorcycle heading for Edmonton so he doesn't have to deal with the fallout from that. And then he's struck by lightning. But yeah, don't worry, he's fine. His bike is melted to the pavement, and all of his clothes have been burned off, but he's fine. He goes to the home of his friends Sandy and Jerry, who tells them about outing himself and the lightning strike, and we're gonna join them back on the highway examining what's left of that motorcycle. This book alternates between Sandy and Gabe's point of view with some flashbacks tossed in there, so this first part is Sandy's point of view. Very sweary, by the way, she swears. It had to be a practical joke, some terrible fucking joke that Gabe had cooked up, maybe with help from their son Sean. Definitely with help from Sean, because where else would he get a bike he could do this to? Fucking Sean, she blurted. And this, going by the expression on Gabe's face, was about the last thing he'd expected her to say. He was standing at the side of the highway, stars for a backdrop and the wind tossing his hair around, and even in Jerry's too long clothes, he came off like a goddamn movie star. Or rock star, which he would likely have preferred, considering what a freak he was for music. Sometimes it was stupidly obvious that he didn't belong around there. Sometimes Sandy wanted to slap him for it. Was this Sean's idea, she asked. You get an old bike and fucking, I don't know, melt it to the highway and cook up this whole story about Colin finding you a guy and haul me and Jerry out here so you could see our faces? Gabe had his head tilted a bit to one side. Everything about his expression said that Sandy had lost her mind. Your hypothesis, he said carefully, is that I outed myself to Sean and invented a story that's pretty much my worst nightmare so I could tell you a bullshit story about my bike getting wrecked. That's your worst nightmare? Jerry asked mildly, Colin walking in on you. He was still regarding the bike, or the bike-like pile of melted plastic and metal, stuck to the road. He nudged some of it with the toe of his shoe and shrugged when it failed to move. Yeah, it's on there pretty good. Careful you don't melt your shoe, Gabe warned. Jerry shook his head. It's mostly cooled off now. What am I supposed to think? Sandy asked Gabe. How else could this have happened and you still be standing here?
Gabe took a deep breath. A trio of cars passed, not slowing at the sight of three people in scrap metal. People were always in a hurry on that road. I think, Gabe said once the cars were gone, I got hit by lightning. That got Jerry to stop studying the X-bike and start looking at Gabe. Out of a clear sky, he said. Yeah, I know, Gabe said, but it's the only sky I've got, and I'm thinking lightning came out of it. Something knocked me off my bike, down the highway, burned off all my clothes, and did that to the bike. So what else could it have been? Jerry gazed at the sky. Meteorite, he offered. Sandy's stomach lurched. Okay, come on, Gabe did not get hit by a fucking meteorite or lightning. Jesus, Gabe, you're telling us you skidded how far? About even with the windbreak, Gabe said, pointing at a row of scraggly trees. Without leathers or a helmet, Sandy said, staring down the highway. You didn't even have a jacket? T-shirt and jeans, Gabe said. Jerry walked around Gabe in a tight circle. No broken bones, no sprains. Nothing, Gabe said, not even a scrape. Jerry whistled. Somebody up there likes you. Gabe smiled. Somebody up there has a love-hate relationship with me, he corrected. Jerry barked out one of his rare laughs. Sandy thought she might throw up. It wasn't funny. This was so not funny. Sandy? Gabe asked softly. She tried on a smile as another group of cars sped past. Whatever happened, she said, no harm done, I guess, except to your bike. Yeah, Gabe said. I don't even think Sean's going to be able to fix it. This is so fucked. How am I going to get up to Koshin next week? It took Sandy a moment to remember that Gabe had a summer job lined up at Koshin, teaching people to windsurf on Jackfish Lake. He'd learned like the rest of them, tooling around on Sandy's dad's old board, and he was certified in exactly nothing. But somehow he talked his way into the gig. The owners probably thought teenage girls would line up for lessons with the hot guy. The owners were probably right. Maybe Sean can lend me a bike, Gabe said. Ah, we'll figure it out, Sandy said. She put a hand on Gabe's shoulder and steered him toward Jerry's dull red Geo. You can bunk with us tonight. Tomorrow, you can see a doctor and make sure you're really okay. Gabe stopped, pushing back against her hand. The motion had more force than she expected, and she had to take a step back to keep her balance. I don't need a doctor, Sandy. See a doctor, Sandy said, and I'll make Sean lend you a bike. Don't see a doctor, and you're hitching. Gabe's shoulders dropped as his face fell, giving a general picture of things rushing toward the ground. Sandy! You're told for a six-year-old, Sandy observed. That's the deal. Stay at our place tonight. Tomorrow morning, Jerry will run you by your house so you can talk to Colin before he leaves for work. And then Jerry will drive you to a mediclinic. Wow, Gabe said, this deal keeps sucking bigger and bigger balls. Nobody consulted Jerry, Jerry pointed out. Or I could phone Colin right now, Sandy said, ignoring Jerry. And I remind you, you will be hitching to Koshin. Colin's probably at the bar, Gabe said, as if that won the game for him. It was bad enough that Gabe and Colin refused to carry cell phones for some bullshit reason, but so much worse that they were obnoxious about it. You can't pin us Reese boys down. Sandy stepped closer so that Gabe had to tilt his head back to look her in the eye. I will call him at the bar, she said. I will call all the bars. She and Gabe stood there for a while, a few more groups of cars worth. One even honked as though the whole freaking road wasn't enough for his ugly-ass sedan, and he resented them taking up the shoulder. They did not, either of them, so much as twitch. Have it your way, Gabe said finally. Sandy smiled and put a hand on his cheek. Thanks, kiddo. She stepped back and to his side, then put an arm around his shoulders and led him to Jerry, who was leaning against the side of his car. Your chariot, Jerry said as they approached, apparently. Until Sean gives him a bike, Sandy assured him, and I'll owe you. Story of my life, Jerry muttered, and something in his eyes told Sandy not to ask what he meant by that. Instead, the three of them said little as the tiny car full of hard drives and towers and cables bounced from the shoulder to the highway and back into town to take them home. This is one of the flashbacks. Gabe is in his bed. He's 8 years old, and he feels awful. He doesn't remember a thing since lunch, and it's dark outside now. Colin crawls in beside him with a book and reads to him about some weird British guys who get lost in outer space. Gabe thinks parts of it are funny, but he doesn't understand a lot of it. He doesn't tell Colin that. He wants Colin to keep reading. There's wintergreen gum on Colin's breath, the kind that, when it's mints, Colin makes sparks with in the dark bathroom. It's his favorite everything, gum, candy, toothpaste. Gabe remembers smelling it in the dark of the basement, Colin sitting with a hand on Gabe's left arm while their dad puts another needle into the right. Whatever it is, it burns going in, tracing a heavy red line up Gabe's arm. He can feel it moving, the pressure, like someone shoved a wire in there. He remembers this clearly for a moment,
And then the memory fades like the line on his arm to Colin's voice in wintergreen air. Gabe sticks up on his quilt at the smell of it. Colin doesn't give him shit for the mess. He just swaps out the blanket and goes to his own room. And this last bit is from Gabe's point of view. Sorry about the yelling last night, Gabe said as he entered the kitchen. Sandy and Jerry were at the table with coffee and bowls of oatmeal and cereal, respectively. Gabe wandered by the toaster and pulled a piece of forgotten toast from his clutches. It was still warm, which was reassuring. Otherwise, there was no telling how many weeks it might have been there. You were dreaming about Colin catching you with a guy? Jerry asked. Gabe stopped midway between the toaster and the fridge to stare at Jerry, without comprehension. See, you said that was your worst nightmare, Jerry explained, and about 3 a.m, you sure sounded like you were having your worst nightmare, so I put 2 and 2 together. Oh, Gabe said. He pointed the toast at Jerry. That's funny. You're very funny. I'm funnier when I've slept, Jerry said. Sandy swatted him with her coffee spoon. Get off him. It's not his fault he had a bad dream. Gabe used the distraction to get into the fridge for a jam and a can of Coke. While he rummaged, Jerry said, it was more pathetic sobbing than yelling. Well, that's a relief, Gabe said, raising his voice to be heard outside the fridge. I thought maybe I sounded undignified. Well, not for a scared little girl, Jerry said. Delightful, Sandy said. I love sexist fuck witter with my morning coffee. Gabe, I thought you'd stopped having nightmares. Yeah, well, Gabe said, sometimes I have one for nostalgia. He spotted a can of store brand cola and grabbed it. You remember this dream? Jerry asked. Gabe shut the fridge. No. He never remembers them, Sandy said. She sounded testy. Also, she was wearing sweatpants and a t-shirt and hadn't even tried to brush her hair, so obviously she'd stumbled straight from her bed to the table. Gabe would have opted not to talk to her, considering these facts, but Jerry had lived with her for a year without losing any important body parts, and this seemed to have made him bold. I remember those 2 years of Colin bitching about getting no sleep, Jerry said, so I'm up on the details. Gabe dropped the dry toast on the counter. He didn't need it. I didn't mean to wake people up, Gabe said. Sandy narrowed her eyes at Jerry before turning to hug the back of her chair and smile at Gabe. We know that. You'd have to be a fucking asshole to blame someone for having nightmares. What time does Reese the Elder work today? Jerry said. Colin doesn't work until 10, Gabe said. Someone else has to do a thing before the rest of the crew can do whatever it is that they're doing. You know, it's too bad Colin didn't try to get you a job at the construction site, Jerry commented. I can picture you now asking people to pass you the poundy thing so you can hit the sticky uppy things. Shove a poundy thing up your sticky thing, Gabe said. Colin and I retiled our roof last summer. I've seen you fuck up a Kinder toy. Can you both be this charming somewhere else, Sandy said. This isn't really a question. Oh my, Jerry said, standing as he spoke. Car, young Gabriel. Gabe raised his drink can at Sandy. Thanks, he said. She smiled. De nada. Say hi to Colin for me. The way Gabe's stomach reacted to that told him it was a good thing he'd given up on the toast. Later, he told Sandy and stepped lively to catch up to Jerry, who was already pulling his jacket on at the door. It was going to be too warm for the jacket within the hour, Gabe estimated, but Jerry overdressed for everything. Once they were squeezed into the geo, Gabe tugged at his jeans, well, Jerry's jeans, and said, I'll switch into my own clothes at my house and I'll give these back to you, unless you want me to wash them first. Wearing my clothes after you've worn my clothes without washing them, Jerry said, straight-faced and eyes on the road. Dear Penthouse Forum. Dear you, Gabe said. Fuck you. I'll wash them and you can pick them up whenever. Don't worry about it, Jerry said with a slanted grin. I can do my own laundry. He shrugged his right shoulder in a strange, twitchy way. Gabe frowned. Something wrong with your arm? Jerry stopped smiling. Boss made me haul some heavy shit, he said. Not part of my job description, the fucker. Gabe nodded and stared out the passenger side window. It wasn't even 10 minutes drive from the duplex to his and Colin's house. 10 minutes tops and he'd be looking Colin in the eye, provided Colin was able and willing to look at him. Unless Gabe rolled down the window and leapt from the geo, but Jerry would probably tell Sandy about that and then there'd be hell to pay. Besides, he'd have to face Colin sometime. You're technically an adult, Jerry said. What's your point? Jerry shrugged. It's your house too, right? Like it was left to both of you? Gabe returned his gaze to the passenger window. I'm still not getting your point. You want to nail some guy in your house? That's your right, Jerry said. Colin's not going to like hearing it, but it might be time that he did. Gabe had nothing to say to that. He watched the blur of purple outside the window, all the lilac bushes going by. Every year of his life had contained 2 weeks of mauve hitting him in the eye. He wasn't sure he'd recognize spring without it. Okay, fine, Jerry said. You're right. It's none of my business. They stopped for a train, and Gabe turned his head out of habit to see if he could spot the end and estimate how long they'd be sitting there. He didn't know whether he wanted the train to be long or short on this day. But someone needs to say it, Jerry said as train cars rolled by. White letters on dark brown, mostly. Was it grain headed for the coast, or did they load that into the tank cars like silos on their sides? A few more cars, some tanks, and then Jerry added, Sandy's not going to say anything, because she thinks the sun shines out of your brother's ass. Not literally, Jerry added. That would be fatal. Gabe turned to stare at him. The sun shines out of your ass, too, Jerry said, glancing at him, so you should be glad that it's not a literal thing. Noted, Gabe said, you harrowing freak. I'm not the one shooting daylight out my butthole, Jerry informed him. Too fucking true, Gabe agreed.
All right. That camera has had it for the night.
Yeah, I suspect it has.
So what we're going to do is we'll do a little question and answer for as long as that might last, but we're going to do it without the camera.
Okay.
So I'm going to just sit here because I'm just as close to the microphone here as I am anywhere else.
Oh my God, Ryan, put your pants back on.
Never! All right. So I don't know, Kim, if you have your phone there. I don't know if anyone is watching this stream anywhere else. I highly doubt it.
Susie's here.
Hey, Susie.
Mark's here.
Mark.
All right. So we'll have a little question and answer. If anybody has any questions, we'll be happy to answer them. It doesn't have to do with our books. We're happy to talk on a wide variety of topics.
It ought to be writing related, I would think.
Sure, but I'm not... You
okay,
know,
whatever.
It's
okay.
A small, it's a small, intimate gathering full
yeah,
of people who mostly know us.
That's
so
true. That is fair.
This
one,
is your time.
The one comment from Mark was that I don't know about the rest of you, but I really appreciate that both of our featured authors are theater kids because it makes the reading much more.
Yes, it does.
And then he also comments that pants are the enemy.
Thank you. They are, in fact, the enemy.
Yeah, it's good actually that you and I both have done a lot of stuff on stage because, yeah, a lot of authors are not inclined to sit in front of people and do much of anything. And, yeah, it's terrifying to have to do a reading when that's not something you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel lucky in that someone else's story is a very conversationally narrated book. Unlike some of the other things I've had to do readings, it's tougher. Like doing readings from Sleeping Underwater was considerably harder than this book.
And also you have a William Burroughs impression.
Well, it's not much of a William Burroughs impression, but I do love the man.
So Wade is now here.
Hello, Wade.
And Mark's first question, apparently it's more than one, is why are y'all like this?
I think it was asking.
Well, I don't know. Well, yeah, I mean, that is possible.
I can tell you why I'm like this, because I actually have an answer. So my mom gave birth to me at a teaching hospital in Calgary. And when I was born, it was a very, very slow night. And her delivery room was full of every student, doctor, and nurse in the building. There was literally a crowd of 15 people while my mom was fully dilated and screaming. And I was born, and for like 30 seconds, half a minute, wouldn't cry, wouldn't take that first breath. And then I did, and they all cheered. That's why I'm like this.
Yeah, it makes sense. I don't know why I'm like this. I know why I write the sort of books I do, which is that I grew up reading so much mystery and science fiction and just genre fiction, pulp fiction. You know, that was the stuff I grew up on. Because my dad would read it, he'd buy a bunch of secondhand books, and then just throw them into my room with little to no thought. I'm actually gonna walk that back with no thought. Whether they were appropriate for someone of my age.
Ken Follett,
yeah. Like honestly, like, the Rex Stout books were great. The Spencer books were good. Like there's no problem there. They were actually Spencer. I actually recommend the first set of Spencer books, like the first 8 or 9 books to teenagers at least. But yeah, Ken Follett. I think 9, 10 is not the right age to find out what hate sex is.
Planet of the Cave Bear when you're a preteen.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
The Holcroft Covenant as a tween.
Nice.
The full adult version of Flowers for Algernon with the castration scene. That's another one.
Oh, yeah.
And like VCM groups.
Yeah, that too.
As a 9 or 10-year-old.
But that was, like, a lot of people thought she was meant for kids. Like,
in school.
Yeah.
In school is for under-18s, and it sort of was horrifying.
What really horrifies me about VC Andrews, actually, I'll get back to that in a second,
But yeah, Flowers for Elton. I think I did a book report on it for the first time when I was 10.
Right.
And then again in high school. So yeah, I used to be able to quote from that book at length, which is probably not appropriate for any setting whatsoever. Yeah, what really horrified me about V.C. Andrews is that over and over I would babysit in houses where they owned two books, the Bible and Flowers in the Attic. Like, why, if you only own one book, is it Flowers in the Attic? What the hell was that?
I don't think Flowers in the Attic is quite as disturbing as My Sweet Adriana, but it's...
Well, it's not as disturbing as the Bible.
That's true.
Yeah.
Hey, now.
But no, for real, like, I could never figure out why that was the book.
Yeah.
If you own one book this lifetime, make it Flowers in the Attic. No! God, no!
And I think another thing that Gailey and I both have in common when it comes to genre fiction is that we were both looking for a kind of alternate parental guidance.
Yeah, that's fair.
And so I learned a lot about how to be a grown-up from reading those Spencer books, for example, and I learned a lot about independence and how to form personal relationships from these books, and I know that's true for you. So it's no surprise to me that you're writing mystery fiction.
So what else does Mark want to know?
He says that actually explains a lot.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Anybody have anything?
Well, you've been writing about, you've been dream writing or sleep writing.
Oh,
God.
And trust me, that some of that poetry you've been sleep writing has been fascinating.
Yeah.
But has any of your books been sort of sleep written?
No, sleep writing is a brand new thing for me, and I don't love it. I think my brain is trying to work through some stuff in the sequel to someone else's story right now, which is a much bigger book, but it's a lot like being haunted by your own ghost. Like, I really do not enjoy waking up and opening my computer and seeing a poem I didn't write that seems portentous of both my own death and the death of others. That's not fun.
I think you're just doing some heavy lifting while you sleep. And you're a very good typist while you sleep, by the way. You make far fewer mistakes. I walked in on him doing it one time because he posted something to Facebook and I immediately posted, like, you'd better be awake right now. And then there's just nothing. I'm like, holy fuck, he's asleep.
Well, and it terrifies me because I used to be a terrible sleepwalker.
You were a very accomplished sleepwalker.
It's true, but I used to be so good at it that I would get dressed and go to work and wake up in a cab. On my way to work, because I worked the night shift for a god-awful number of years, and the only way I could be 100% certain that I had done all this was because I wasn't wearing underwear.
Yeah.
Good commando. For some reason, that presented too much of a challenge. So I got my smock on. Yep. My outfit of my own personal demeaning is on. Got work pants on and no drawers. Yep. Awesome. I'm asleep. And that part of my life has been over for a long time since I got my CPAP machine. And now I'm up all night for good fun again, apparently.
Truly.
Yeah. I'm sorry that you had to experience that, though. That's genuinely creepy to walk in a room and see somebody
completely. Yeah, but it was fairly... But I'm trying to talk to that guy, and he just doesn't acknowledge me, which is too bad.
Well, it's probably better than when I am sleepwalking and he's not driving the boat and I'm just a whiny toddler, so...
Well, I mean, the toddler thing, at least I'm used to, that's like, I don't mean that like it sounded, but like, toddler you makes sense. Toddler you is like, you only, you're like a little kid and you're just overtired and bratty and you need to go to bed.
Yeah.
And yeah, I can deal with that because I just basically send you to bed. But yeah, your sleep writer, that's someone else. I don't know that guy.
I don't know that guy either, and I don't like it. But I haven't done it in a while now, so hopefully that is finished.
So Susie asks, when did the ideas for these books come to you?
Well, Lightning Strike Blues was, Ryan had a superheroes game. It started as a champions game, and then it was his own system that he used. Yeah, Gabe came out of that, and so did Colin, and Sandy, and Jerry, actually. And then, yeah, we tried to sort of take that role-playing game experience and turn it into radio scripts, TV scripts, that kind of thing, and eventually it just kind of didn't go anywhere, so I asked Ryan
if he would give me his blessing for characters that were shared characters like Colin. And then, you know, the other characters that I, well, my characters, and take them off and write a different book about them. So there's a lot of similarities between things that happen in that game, but it's a very different story. It's a different setting.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of weird for me reading it because it's so different and the characters are still so familiar.
Yeah, it's, but it's always an interesting thing trying to turn a role-playing game into a book. If you've read the Wildcard series, which other people are like, oh, Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire, you know, oh, George R.R. Martin. No, for me, George R.R. Martin's greatest stuff is being the editor for Wildcards. Those were the books I loved. And those were all from a role-playing game that they just sort of got together and wrote their own characters and their own short stories based on that, and I think it was fantastic. But it's hard work because you really have to distill, you know, maybe 2 years of meeting once a week or once every 2 weeks for game sessions into something that people can understand, and try and pick out what is interesting and relevant and what is necessary to drive the story from all the dicking around and the funny bits, and you know, but also not trying to lose things that are really funny and fun and different.
Which is the dicking around.
Yeah, which is the dicking around. Yeah. So it's tough. It's really it's a challenge. And
yep.
The Unsog game, I think would be a lot of fun to. I mean, not that either of us has the luxury of time, but I think that would be a fun story to write as a novel too.
Yeah, sometimes you can take the stuff that happens in those games and kind of transliterate it, and sometimes you lose that magic.
Yeah, well, and for people who haven't done it, it's really kind of like being in a really cool TV show where you are both the audience and the writer and the actor and the character, and every 2 weeks or so you get together and watch another episode of the show.
Yep.
But it's just for you and the other people at the table.
Yeah, there's not enough of that anymore. It used to be that was the whole of human society, is we'd sit together around a fire and tell each other stories, and role-playing is kind of like that.
Yeah.
Someone else's story, the idea for it, came about originally because I had this feeling that I think a lot of people do, where they feel like a supporting character in someone else's life. And I think it's something that is particularly common with queer folks as they get older. You know, they don't have their own kids, so they kind of form their families, right? And they find these ties. And so I said, well, wouldn't it be fun if I took Tom, who was a minor character in Sleeping Underwater and the framing device for my first book, Silver Bullets. He's the journalist in that book. And I had something happen to him that was ostensibly remarkable, but he was actually off stage for everything super important that happens, which is in fact the case in someone else's story. He is never there when the most important things happen. By the end of the book, he is as mystified as the readers about why certain things have happened, and he just wants to go home. And that's kind of the entire point of the book. He just wants to go home. He's got this young friend, Lisa, that he lives with, or lives in the same building with, that he spends time with and hangs out with, and he just wants to go home. He is sick of being alive except for little things that give him pleasure. And so he's not interested in the big story. So I sat down and I did this, and I needed an antagonist. And I've always loved Mary Shelley's book, Frankenstein. I mean, I've loved Frankenstein in general, but I particularly love that book. And I thought I wanted to write something where his characterization was true to the way that they are in the book, but with nigh on 200 years more life, and what's happened to him, and what's he about, and what were the experiences that founded him. And I'm very pleased to have done that reasonably well, I think. I got an email from a Frankenstein scholar who read my book, to my astonishment. I have no idea how they got it, honestly, but they read the book and said that obviously, yes, it's kind of a comic pastiche of the creature, but that the way that he speaks and the way that he looks at the world and the way that he goes through these rages is true to the character. And I felt really happy about that, because in some ways it's a profoundly silly book, and in other ways it's a profoundly sad one. But it's kind of about how we all have to reinvent ourselves. And so I wrote it over the course of a 3-day novel weekend and then revised it, and here we are.
Ryan once was in a play in Saskatoon, and they asked him for an actor bio, and he said that he was created in Ingolstadt, Bavaria.
Created in Ingolstadt, Bavaria in 1787.
Mm-hmm.
and that he was the author of the famous theater treatise, Drama Good, Fire Bad.
The best part of that is that somebody went into a bookstore on Broadway and asked for it.
How's your performance of Putting on the Ritz?
I do that one reasonably well, especially now that I've got this terrible friggin' edema. But yeah, that's someone else's story. And Selsari, the island that it's about, I mean, I've talked to most of you about it, so you know, but there's a widely held belief that I've made up the island and that it doesn't exist, and I will tell you that that's not correct. The island is real. I have been there. That just doesn't jibe up with the consensus reality, and I appreciate that, but I've been there. It's real. Okay. Oh yeah, you're just humoring me. You're nodding over there, nodding like the smug, smug person you are. I see that. Yeah. Any other questions, please, God?
Change the subject, is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing yet.
Nothing yet, anyone else?
Have the Mark is saying hooray for CPAP machines.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm ready for CPAP preventing him from being a cyborg.
Yeah, if you think you need a CPAP, or if the person you live with thinks you need a CPAP, don't hesitate. You will feel better.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
It changed my entire life.
Stopped my ex from smothering me in my sleep.
Well, if no one else has any questions, yes, go ahead.
Before we release this one, you did the online novel, the little serial novel.
Still
oh, yeah, the talking about the Dominion with
Dominion.
The author.
Yeah, what's going on with that? Is it going to be like in print at some point or
January?
Oh,
yeah.
That's soon. Wow.
Yeah, that's an interesting book because that one actually got written during the 3-day, but it was the 3-day book television reality TV show. And I wound up winning the show with that novel. And yeah, that was how my friend Pam was here tonight, how she and I got to know each other by standing around a garbage can together at 3:00 in the morning.
Yep.
It was a wild experience. Yeah, they locked 12 authors in a chapters and had us write books over 3 days and do televised challenges and that kind of thing. It was a blast. We had a great time.
Just to explain this to you folks here who may not know and anyone who is listening to us, the Dominion is on a web app right now called Yonder. It's still there. It was serialized in, I don't remember how many parts, but almost 50 of them, I think.
It's a lot.
A lot of parts, and you can go there and read it. Yonder is this experimental platform that's trying to get people interested in serialized fiction again, as was the case in the 19th century and the early 20th century. So it's all there right now, but the print edition is coming out on January.
Yeah, what happened is my publisher, They were a little mad at me, and for real, like they were a little mad at me. My editor called me and she was like, the problem with you is you have too many good ideas. So they prefer that you have like one series, like my Ben Ames Case Files mystery series, and that you just keep plugging away at that series, and that, you know, people then eventually buy like all 10 of the books or all 12 or 20 or whatever it is. And I was like, for one thing, I don't want to have the impulse to throw my characters over the Reichenbach Falls. And for another thing, I do have other stuff I want to write. So I sent her Lightning Strike Blues, and she was like, yeah, we want to buy this. Fuck you. And so now you got two series. And I was like, yeah, but wait, there's more. And then I sent her the Dominion, and they weren't sure, like, they wanted it, but they weren't sure they kind of had a place for it. And then this thing with Yonder came up where Yonder wanted to buy a bunch of books from them. And they were like, well, this book is excellent for serialization because it's written a chapter from one character, a chapter from another character, so they thought it pieced out really well. And so they decided to buy it for that, and because they bought it for that, they've also bought it for ebook and print, so that'll be this January. I don't know what stats are like on Yonder. I suspect this is a pathetically low number, but I just passed 2,000 readers on it, so.
And I have no idea if that's good or bad either.
I suspect it's terrible.
Yeah,
but
who knows.
Didn't we have the impression that Yonder seems to be a more of a
smut?
Yeah.
Yes, it's largely related to smut. You're not incorrect.
Yeah,
so if you manage to get 2,000 readers for that book,
yeah.
Good
like,
for
yeah.
you.
Yeah, and nobody gets their dick out on camera in the Dominion, so they don't. They get their dick out like in.
Oh, in the spaces. Yeah, you're right.
It's
implied.
Totally implied, but it
implied dick
stage,
exposure,
yeah.
But no
yeah.
active dick exposure. I see what you're saying.
So, like, yeah, for that, it's doing quite well on a smut based channel, I would
yeah,
say.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess I can be proud. But yeah, it'll be nice to have the actual physical book, and I love how the cover turned out. The head of the company, the head of the publishing company, and I worked on it together as kind of like a travelogue based look.
I'm so excited for that one.
Yeah,
and it is a travelogue as well, so it's
yeah.
it's literally a travelogue of this fictional city called Dominion, and it's wonderful.
If you do it right, you can turn it into a setting and sell it on the DM's Guild or something.
Oh, I never thought of that. That's a very cool idea. That's a great idea.
No, don't.
So your editor's going to love you again.
You have already got an insuperable deadline coming
up. Oh, yeah, I do. That's true.
Because Galen's publisher really likes her and is buying so many books.
Are they paying?
Oh, yes,
yeah.
They do. They actually pay me. But they've been up to date with the royalties. I know where everything's at. They've been incredibly transparent. Like,
okay.
It's been great.
I just wanted to...
Yeah, I know. I know. They've had hitches in the past. yeah. But everyone there has honestly been fantastic to me.
But yeah... The other thing I want to say about Girl Whose Lock Ran Out and The Man Who Lost His Pan, the two books in the Ben Ames series, is that the first one, Galen had the luxury of kind of writing on her own time.
Yeah.
And taking her time with, and then the editing process was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But they needed the second book in a frankly ridiculous period of time.
Couple of months.
Yeah. So she sat down and wrote that book in a full-on... sprint of monumental effort and then slept for a long time.
Well, I did that, and then they needed Lightning Strike Blues right away so that they could tell me whether they wanted to buy it or not, and I thought, yeah, no problem. I've got two versions of it. I just need to, like, marry them. It'll be, like, no big deal. And then I realized I had to actually rewrite the entire thing.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, after that, I literally had... I didn't know that mental exhaustion was, like, actually a medical thing where you had symptoms and stuff. I know that now.
Yeah.
It was kind of cool. I thought I was truly losing it. I could not remember anything.
Well, I'm glad you went through the experience, because the book that I'm working on right now was, again, another one of these three-day novels.
Yeah.
But I need to expand it into a bigger novel. And I thought it was going to be a stone-cold breeze. I'm just pick up this book, and I'm just going to add... No.
No, I know. It's horrible. It's actually worse. It's worse than starting from scratch.
I'm gonna
fit it into what you've already done.
I have got to start over with a third less plot, at least, and pray that I get it done, because I'm now also on a deadline. So, yeah.
It's nice to be wanted.
It is nice to be wanted.
And what's this book about?
Oh my gosh. So it's kind of the climax of the Selsari stuff in the short term. It's called Wonderland. And the book opens with the Roswell disaster, crash, whatever. And it turns out that the wreckage that was recovered at Roswell was not an alien saucer. It was a balloon full of munchkins from Oz. And that's how the book starts, and then it gets weird. Wendy.
After that, it goes off the rails a little.
It does. Wendy from Peter Pan is one of the protagonists. Pan is a very, very bad person in this book. Frankenstein's monster gets into an extended 35-page fist fight with my immortal cowboy from Silver Bullets. So if you ever wanted to see a cowboy fight the Frankenstein monster, it's going to be the book for you. But yeah, it's utterly bananas, and I kind of wish I hadn't decided to do this. I should have paid more attention to what you did, because it was a bad idea.
Yeah,
but at least you don't have to do that anymore. Yeah,
end.
Maybe it will be. Well, I mean, yours was. Will mine be? I have no idea.
It's up to you.
Yeah. Any other questions?
So Lightning Strike Blues, you said, is that going to be, is there another follow-up?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so that was the other thing. I reached out to my publisher to be like, hey, guess what? Like, my parents are having health problems, and I need some time, and I don't think I can meet the end of October deadline for The Man Who Hated Clouds, which is the next in the Ben Ames series. Can I get an extension to the end of December? And she said, yes, you can. And I hate to ask you for anything, but not this time. And, yeah, what she wanted was, she said that we like to pre-sell
books. So we know we've got The Man Who Hated Clouds, but we want to know what the title and plot are going to be, like the title and basically the very rough, vague, you know, one paragraph, what is happening in the next Ben Ames book. And we need that for the next book in the Lightning Strike Blues series, and we need it for the next book in the Dominion. So I have to come up with those. But I have them now. So yeah, after these two, The Man Who Hated Clouds is set in Edmonton, and it's kind of set in kind of nerd land. It's about a manuscript that gets stolen. And then after that, there's going to be The Woman Who Went on Midnights, which is going to be set in Saskatoon at a radio station. Which is an interesting coincidence, purely a coincidence that I used to work at a radio station in Saskatoon, and I think everyone understands that anything they read in that book is probably just fiction and not anything that really happened.
Right.
You're going to have the line, I'll see you at midnights where you belong, right?
Of course.
Okay, good.
Yeah, okay, all my best stories are from radio. They have, in radio, they have these things called assistant program directors. And an assistant program director is a person who's kind of in charge of all the DJs on their station. So we had an AM station and an FM station at this time. And we had an AM APD and we had an FM APD. And they hated each other. And one of the things you do as an APD is a thing called an air check. So for every one of your jocks has to do an air check with you. They come to your office, they sit down, and they bring a tape or whatever these days, probably a flash drive, of their show, and you go through it together, and the APD tells the DJ, you did this very well, you did this very badly, never do that again, you know, and they kind of try to make them a better DJ. So we've got the AM and the FM APD together in the voice tracking room. Also in the voice tracking room is the former weather guy from STV Global.
You're going to start giving away names and make this book actionable.
I will hear.
Okay, well, we're on the internet
live.
Oh,
yeah, that's true. We are on the
internet. I'm going to remind you of that, though,
yeah,
coach.
It's like his second day at the station, and he's trying to voice track, and the room's a goddamn broom closet, and so now he's got two APDs blocking his exit, so even if he wants to leave, and he wants to leave, he can't get out. And the AM guy turns to the FM guy and says, and remember, these guys are at the same level in the hierarchy. They have the same job, just at two different stations. Turns to the FM guy and says, you know, we haven't done an air check in a while. Why don't you come by my office and we'll do that. And the FM guy, in a weird moment of wit for a very thick man, says, yeah, we should do an air check. Why don't you bring one of your tapes by and I'll be happy to do an air check with you anytime. So basically turning around and saying, like, oh no, you don't tell me how to do a show, I'll tell you how to do a show. At which point the AM guy grabs the FM guy by the front of his shirt, slams him up against a wall of ancient recording media that's no longer used. The entire room shakes and yells, I'll see you on midnights where you belong!
Gillian used to come home from the radio station with these stories like of epic political backbiting in the most podunk fucking setting possible.
So sad. And that poor guy, the poor weatherman, he quit his job at the TV station because he thought this was a step up. And I just remember him coming downstairs just ghost white, just like, I think I made a mistake. What happened, honey? Well, we're like, oh, sweetie, that's just radio. Like, just, you'll be fine. You'll be fine.
WKRP was a documentary.
It is. It is a fucking documentary. Like, you don't realize it until you work for radio. Whenever someone made a really bad mistake at the radio station, we'd start our apology with, as God is my witness.
Yeah. All right. Well,
so
folks.
So what's the titles for Dominion?
Seven Leagues Over Seven Cities is the Dominion one, and it's going to be about an island that has variably 5 to 7 cities on it, depending on where reality is shifting that week. And they've gone there to try and find out how... one of the premises of the Dominion is that around World War II, suddenly there was magic in the world. So all the things that you read about in fairy tales and stuff were just real, and they happened in the world. And the world hadn't been like that. And people sort of think, like, maybe a long, long time ago it was, and then it stopped having magic, and then it started again, and we don't know why. So the two characters, main characters in the Dominion decide they're going to go find out why, what happened. So they're on this island trying to find that out. That'll be the next book. And the next one for here is, it's tough because it gives something away, but basically Gabe got his powers because of some stuff that his father did with a group of people that were maybe super powerful. Yeah. And he's going to try and find out who those people are and get them just They're up in his business, and he'd prefer they weren't, so.
Oh.
What's the title?
I
forget, too. I was just going to ask you, and I couldn't remember.
Yeah. I really liked it, too. I came up with something really good. And
I hope
it was again, related to the, like, music.
Yeah,
and
they're all going to be music.
Something
titles.
Fugue?
No, it's
something.
Not fugue. I'll find
I
it.
Can't remember. But, oh, if you read Lightning Strikes Blues, and you must, what I want you to tell me, and tell Gaylene, is whether or not Gabe's 100-and-some-odd-year-old boyfriend is as creepy and
He's
awful.
He's not 100-and-some years old. That's an earlier version of the book.
Okay, good.
He's like 20-something.
Oh, I'm good. Because, yeah, originally he was like 130, and I hated his guts. He was like Edward Cullen.
Well, he's not.
Well, now he's not. Good.
Get over it.
Well, no.
Hey, May December is not always bad.
May December of a century ago is always terrible.
The entire fantasy romance genre
would
like word
run. The boy is 18 years old. Just when Lightning Strike Blues begins. Right?
Yeah.
Is he even 18? Is he?
He's
okay.
18.
Okay. Good. This guy in the original draft of the book was like 136 years old and he looked like he was young, but he had all this experience
and
world stuff and I was just like,
now, so get over it.
No,
You're holding a previous version of the book against Eli, and it's not his fault.
He's still a creep. Eli is still a creep. I love the book. But Eli is a creep.
18-year-olds are dating anybody over about 20. They're usually a creep.
Yeah, it's true. The thing about Eli is he's
a strong thing to call.
He's a really good...
Oh, well, that's normal then.
Yes.
He's a really good guy, Gabe, despite being an asshole. Like, I really love this kid in the book, and he can do so much better.
And he might.
So much better than Eli.
Okay, yeah, that tracks, so she's got it correct.
Yeah.
Isn't it being 18?
It's very much being 18.
Yeah, but I'm like his papa, and I can't look at it. Colin needs to make him act right. Anyway, I'm sorry, because like I said, I get real emotional about these characters, because they're my babies, and I love them. I saw Gabe grow up.
Gay guy dating a 50-year-old, dating. Mm-hmm. Tracks, at least for a short period, yeah.
Yeah, the gap isn't like that, but I don't know that this is I wouldn't say that they're necessarily end game, as the kids say.
Yeah, well, I hope that, because he can do better. Don't date a guy just because he has the same stupid secret origin as you. Just because you were all lab rats from the same evil scientist doesn't mean you have to bulk.
How about because you're from North Battleford, he's good looking, and you have never had a blowjob?
Valid.
Those are both really strong reasons.
He's from North Battleford, I will grant you that.
And
Eli is good looking because you wrote him to be, even though I pictured him as an ancient crone person. But never having had a blowjob. Never having gotten a blowjob, I simply don't buy, because the book begins with Colin walking in on him in the middle of coitus, and I'm sorry. I believe he got one.
Okay, how old is the guy that he gets caught with?
The guy he gets caught with is like in his 30s, maybe 40.
Married?
I don't know. He, in a previous version of the book, he was like more of a character. Not married, no.
Yeah.
But
just because he's in his 30s,
he's definitely an asshole.
He knows what he's doing.
No, well, that's true. But I would posit that Eli has no more idea what he's doing with this guy, because Eli was raised by a secret society to serve one function, and that function is not BJ's. So, you know.
We don't know that.
Yeah, you don't know that. But enthusiasm goes a long way.
You know, I'm so glad this is all being recorded for posterity. Because this level of literary salon is something that we haven't seen since the Algonquin, so.
Yeah, actually, this is not that far off from the Algonquin.
I know that they didn't discuss a lot of stuff.
I guarantee this kind of thing got discussed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is very on brand.
100,000%. And I have often said that Gaylene reminds me so much of Dorothy Parker that it hurts.
I had lunch at the Algonquin Hotel when I was in New York, and I asked to see the round table, and they were so apologetic because it was being sent out to be refinished or something. But they were also delighted that somebody asked, how is it that I was the first person in like years and years to come in there and ask to see the round table? I don't understand this world.
I was there. I saw the round table.
Ah,
just like people in New York get real blasé about anything that didn't happen 10
but
minutes ago.
But you think tourists would go look.
You'd think so.
I was very excited about it.
And we had a really nice lunch there, too. Like, it wasn't, at lunch, it's not expensive.
All right, it is 8:45.
So if you are Dorothy Parker reincarnate, who is Ryan?
Oh, Christ.
Oh, are you Benchley then? That would make sense.
I don't think I am. For one thing, you would not be Mrs. Benchley.
That's true.
Who am I? I don't know. Somebody, was it?
You're that guy that I have the Alexander
Hamilton?
No,
my
Wolf
name
Ruff?
Is Alexander Hamilton. There's a million things I haven't done.
I have a biography of him signed by its author who was in the Algonquin Round Circle.
Wolcott,
Alexander Wolcott.
Wow, that's incredibly flattering, because I think I'm more like Wilkie Collins, according to Philippe Saint-Denis, or Anne, as she is also known. She's the one who said I looked like Wilkie Collins, and then I went on the internet and looked up Wilkie Collins, and I died inside a little.
I would support Wilcott.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah.
He was a friend of Rex Stout's.
That's true. Anyway, folks, it's 8:45, and if anybody has any questions, we'll take them, but otherwise I'm going to end the live broadcast.
Yeah, and there's books for sale, and there's food. We've got, like, I don't, is there donuts and stuff, too?
There are Timbits, a ridiculous quantity as it happens, and coffee, also in a ridiculous quantity for the size
and
of the car.
And there's Diet Coke, and there's juice, and there's cookies, and there's also some candy over here, and there's, like, little bits of, like, bookmarks and collateral, and there's a little calendar thing, and there's a, oh, I love these. Door hangers.
Yes, there's bookmarks, posters. Feel free to take them if you wish. They are free to our guests. And folks who are with us on the internet, we're going to sign off now. So thank you. Anne, we were just talking about you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She left her jobs. And
we can't stand you, Anne. We just all talked about it. We hate you. It's mostly because you called me. It's mostly because you just called me Wilkie Collins on the internet the other day, and I'm still bruised.
I like Wilkie Collins. You shouldn't take it as an insult.
Have you seen the man's picture?
Wilkie Collins.
It's also true, and I resent it. But
Wilkie Collins and I agree on what Wilkie Collins' best book was.
Well, all right.
And nobody else in the world does.
What's his best book?
The Woman in White.
Yes. The Woman in White. Yeah, well, yes. Anne agrees.
Okay.
Everybody says Moonstone, but
it's
that book's
not. The Moonstone's bullshit.
That book's crap. All right.
Crap.
On that topic, with
the
Moonstone being.
Wilkie Collins had Wright put on his tombstone.
That's right. So Wilkie Collins, the Moonstone is crap. Thank you for joining us on the internet. Good night. we're going to just have fun with the folks who are here. Thank
also,
you so much
my
for coming.
Ass was at the first